Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Neuro Experience podcast. I'm Louisa. I'm the host. Today's interview is with Matt Kaebelin from the University of Washington. Matt is globally recognized for his research on the biology of aging. In this episode, Matt defines aging and talks extensively about the importance of caloric restriction as it relates to extending lifespan. Lifespan is always a controversial topic because we have so many unknown risk factors that can accelerate aging, but we also have many risk factors that can delay aging. However, it's not as simple as just knowing the risk factors. There's so much more at play. Matt discusses the current state of the literature of testing rapamycin in animals and humans. We even touch on Alzheimer's disease and why rapamycin seems to be a promising drug for patients with Alzheimer's disease. We talk about Matt's dog aging project, and he provides insights on the connection between aging and disease, biomarkers of aging, and epigenetic clocks. So if you're interested in these topics and you're also interested in mTOR, the mTOR pathway and exercise and nutrition as it relates to longevity, then I definitely think that you're going to love this interview. And for those people who are not new to the podcast, you would have heard my many conversations around exercise, sleep and nutrition as it relates to certain disease states, especially lifespan. And in this episode, Matt really cracks down on the molecular mechanisms of how nutrition, calorie restriction, exercise, sleep, all of the things that Mother Nature has gifted us with interplays with longevity. I definitely think a part two is on the cards in the near future. If you like this episode, please spend a moment writing a written review in Apple iTunes. Tell us your thoughts. Without further delay, here is my conversation with Matt Kaebelin. Welcome to the Neuro Experience podcast, where you will learn the science of human performance and optimization. Matt, thank you so much for agreeing to do this podcast. I'm a fan of your work and a fan of your space. So I'm really honored that you're giving us the time to sit down and talk to us about your research and everything else you know about aging and health span. So I already know a lot about your background, but for the listeners, why don't you give us a brief rundown on what you currently do, where you're working, and what your research entails?
A professor of laboratory medicine and pathology at the University of Washington. I've been studying the biology of aging really since I was a graduate student. And what I mean by that are the cellular, molecular, biochemical mechanisms that cause a young animal to become old. And I think that's really an interesting and important area of biomedical research, because we know that that biology of aging is really what creates the permissive physiology for many, maybe all of the functional declines and diseases that go along with old age. And so I think that's a really important thing to study, because if we can understand that biology, we have the potential to actually be able to modulate it in a way that will delay, maybe in some cases even reverse, the functional declines that go along with old age. So that's really what my research has been broadly centered around. And throughout the course of my career, you know, I've worked in very simple model systems like single-celled yeast or nematode worms. Those are really valuable tools to use, because we can perform experiments in a relatively quick period of time, a few weeks, as opposed to do a lifespan in a mouse, you're talking 3 or 4 years. So I've worked in those models. I've worked in, done a lot of studies in mice looking at the biology of aging. Fairly recently, the last 10 years or so, started thinking about translating some of what we've learned in these laboratory models into the real world, both in humans, but primarily in companion animals and pet dogs in particular. So I'm the co-director of a large project called the Dog Aging Project, which is really trying to understand the biology of aging in pet dogs living at home with their owners. We also have a clinical trial as part of that project, testing whether or not the drug rapamycin can increase lifespan, increase health span in pet dogs. So And rapamycin and the protein that rapamycin inhibits, which is called mTOR, mechanistic target of rapamycin, has also been an area where my research has had an extra interest. I end up talking a lot more about rapamycin and mTOR than a lot of people, but that's only really a small part of what my research has been focused on. But it certainly has been a theme that we've been interested in for the past 15 years or so.
I mean, every time I look at mTOR and rapamycin, it's always fascinating. But I'm happy that you said you're working on modulating the aging process. I know that there is so much to it rather than just saying, okay, we have these 9 hallmarks of aging, so let's just work on inhibiting those and we'll be able to live to 1,000 years old. Evidently, it's not that easy. So why don't we have a look at the ground up and first identify what aging is. And we can have respect to these 9 hallmarks if you can remember all of them. I always have a hard time remembering them, but famous paper, you know, that showed the 9 hallmarks of aging. We can start there if you like.
Sure. There's a couple of things I would say. Again, I think I try to be careful when people ask me what is aging to specify that I, in part because of, you know, my career and what I've been doing for the last 20 plus years, I immediately gravitate towards biological aging, right? I think that people mean different things when they use that word, and I think it's really important to be precise in what we mean. So I'm going to focus on biological aging, which I just defined a few minutes ago in a conceptual sense. What is it at a molecular level? And that's where I think we get into the hallmarks of aging. And there's a couple things I would say about the hallmarks. One is I think they have been extremely valuable to the field because they have sort of formalized many of the mechanisms that we are confident play a role in the biological aging process across the animal kingdom. There's a couple of things that's important to say specifically, though, beyond that. One is they're interconnected. So you can't modulate cellular senescence without affecting mitochondrial function, without affecting nutrient response, without affecting DNA damage, right? So these things are tightly interconnected. And so the way I think about the hallmarks is they represent a network of interactions as opposed to individual things that we want to fix necessarily or target specifically. I think you can have an impact by targeting individual hallmarks. You're going to have a much bigger impact if you can tweak the entire network. And that's where I think mTOR turns out to be a particularly interesting target for the biology of aging, because it seems to affect all of the hallmarks of aging. So if you turn down mTOR, you have what you would consider a positive impact on all of the hallmarks of aging. So they're tightly interconnected, and that's really important to appreciate. The other thing I would say is, and this is where I think the hallmarks have been a little bit, I don't know if harmful is the right word, counterproductive, because I think they have narrowed the thinking of the field quite substantially because they have been the sort of place that everybody immediately goes when they talk about the biology of aging. It's become very hard for people to look outside of the hallmarks. And I am absolutely confident there is a lot we don't know about the biology of aging that doesn't fit neatly into the hallmarks of aging. And if we don't look at it, we're never going to learn about it. And we're never going to do better. My feeling is it's unlikely we're going to do better than caloric restriction in terms of magnitude of effect size if we don't get beyond the hallmarks of aging and understand what else is out there. That's an opinion. I want to say I don't have data to support that. I could be wrong. I'd love to be wrong, but that's my guess. And I think it's important for people to appreciate, while there has been a massive amount of progress in the field, in some ways, it has also been a little bit disappointing that caloric restriction is still the biggest, has the biggest effect on longevity of any non-genetic intervention that we know about in laboratory animals. And we've known about caloric restriction since the 1930s. So why haven't we done better? Honestly, I think it's a large part because people are looking under the lamppost and studying what they already know. And I think the hallmarks have reinforced that, because it becomes very hard to get support to study something that doesn't fit within the framework of the hallmarks of aging. And the one thing I'll say, the one thing that gives me hope, is that the only approach that I can think of right now that has a real chance of doing better than caloric restriction is epigenetic reprogramming. That might work. That might actually be substantial in the effect size. But I think it's important to point out, nobody has yet shown you can even extend lifespan with epigenetic reprogramming. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it hasn't even, the data that's out there isn't even anywhere close to as good as rapamycin. And yet people are talking about reversing aging, which is nonsense in my opinion.
Hey team, I want to jump here quickly and just talk to you about Momentous. So the Neuro Experience podcast has teamed up and partnered exclusively with Momentous. And we get a lot of questions coming in on Instagram, both my page, the Neuro Athletics page, and on the Neuro Experience website regarding supplementation. So we partnered with Momentous quite a few months ago for three very important reasons. First of all, the quality of their supplements are second to none in terms of purity and precision in the amounts of the ingredients that they put in their supplements. So quality is by far the most important aspect when choosing supplements. So we get all of our supplements from there, and this is where we point all of our guests to. So if you go to livemomentous.com/neuro, you will see the recommendations that I have put out there as it relates to brain health. You will, of course, see my omega-3 on there, advertised on there, of course. You'll see a sleep pack. Now, this is for the introduction to sleep supplements for people. You've got L-theanine in there, you've got apigenin, you've got magnesium, L-threonate, you've got everything in there to support a healthy night's sleep. So I don't point anyone towards melatonin. So this is a great introductory pack for anybody who's looking at enhancing their sleep quality. So if you're looking for quality supplements, also one that could ship almost anywhere throughout the world, but mainly the US and Australia, head on over to livemomentous.com/neuro and you will get 15% off absolutely anything. Keep in mind to use Neuro, N-E-U-R-O at checkout for all of your supplements from Momentous. Now, the second sponsor of today's episode is 8Sleep. So we all know that quality sleep is what matters. It's not just about quantity. And if you're talking about quality, then you cannot look further than temperature. So temperature, we know, is something big that we need to take into place. If you're in Australia, it's ramping up now. The temperature is getting hot. If you're in the US, the temperature is starting to cool down, especially here in New York City. Either way, our body needs to drop, well, our core body temperature needs to drop at least 2 degrees in order to fall asleep and stay asleep. And it's really hard to maintain. We also need to heat up a little bit as we are waking up. So this whole notion of temperature control is very hard to maintain unless you are sleeping on smart technology. And that's exactly what 8Sleep is. And I can safely say that 8Sleep has changed the way that I sleep, and it's changed the amount of total sleep time that I'm getting. So the Pod Pro cover is what I sleep on, and the Pod Pro cover by 8Sleep is one of the most advanced solutions on the market for thermoregulation. So you can be sleeping as cool as 55 degrees Fahrenheit or as hot as 110 degrees Fahrenheit. So if you want to be sleeping at your best, head on over to 8sleep.com/neuro. And right now, through November and early December, they are having a holiday sale. So you can get even more off your Pod Pro cover or off your mattress if that's the way you choose to go. So go to 8sleep.com/neuro. Do your research. Check it out. If you want to purchase a mattress, you can save immensely by using code NEURO at checkout. Yeah, and we're going to get into sirtuins as well. When you talk about calorie restriction and fasting, this is such a big field and one that's often misunderstood as well. And you also speak about it outside of genetic mutation. So let's talk about if I'm correct, let's talk about calorie restriction and what that actually means. Because a lot of people hear calorie, is that you know, restricting yourself to 500 calories per day? Is that out time locked with, you know, 16-hour fasting? What exactly is calorie restriction as it relates to lifespan?
Right. So again, I think it's really important to be clear. What we know about caloric restriction and lifespan, and to some extent health span, really comes from animal studies in the laboratory. So mostly mice and rats, although people have done lots of caloric restriction studies in invertebrate models as well. But I think for today's purposes, let's just talk about what we know in mammals, in rodents, mostly mice, but also data in rats. So what's clear there is that at least in many genetic backgrounds, mostly inbred genetic backgrounds, caloric restriction defined as a reduction in caloric intake sort of across the board. So if you think about the macronutrients, carbs, protein, fat, you just reduce everything by X percent. That is sufficient. And as long as you supplement for micronutrients and vitamins, that's sufficient to increase lifespan. And the magnitude of effect is roughly proportional to the degree of restriction. And what I mean by that is 20% restriction in calories compared to what's called ad libitum free feeding gives you about a 20% increase in lifespan, mean lifespan across the population. That's been shown up to about a 60% reduction in calories, all the way up to about a 60% increase in average lifespan of the population can be achieved by straight caloric restriction, at least in certain genetic backgrounds. So that's what's clearest in the literature. The other thing that's clear is not every genetic background responds the same. And it seems like, and these studies can be criticized a little bit, but it seems like about 30% of the genetic backgrounds in mice where a given caloric restriction level has been applied, 40% I think is what has been done most often, you get no effect. Or in some cases, you actually get a shortening of lifespan. That often gets left out of the discussion of caloric restriction, that there is a, you know, greater than 0% of genetic backgrounds that are harmed by caloric restriction, even in mice, when you're looking at lifespan. So then the question becomes, what about other versions of caloric restriction? Ketogenic diet, protein restriction, time-restricted feeding, intermittent fasting. So my take home there, and some people will disagree with this, but I think the literature is pretty clear. None of those things, let's set aside protein restriction because that gets really complicated. So protein restriction is a different beast. Ketogenic diet, intermittent fasting, time-restricted feeding, none of those things robustly increase lifespan or health span unless you also calorically restrict. So most of the effect, not all, most of the effect comes from eating less, not from when you eat. That seems to be what the data in mice and rats strongly supports. You can get a tiny effect alone from intermittent fasting if it's isocaloric, but it's much, much smaller than you get from caloric restriction.
Well, I'm glad you cleared that up because it makes it much easier to calorie restrict outside of a time frame, you know, dependent on what your lifestyle is like.
Yeah. So I think, and again, this is where I think it gets murky, right? Is because can we translate directly from the animal studies to humans? I think that's an open question. And then the question that I'm really interested in, but I don't have a strong sense one way or the other, is whether or not there are benefits to things like intermittent fasting or time-restricted feeding in the absence of weight loss. So I think for people who are at an unhealthy weight, which is a lot of people, right? I mean, that's just a fact of modern life. People who are overweight, I think those strategies can be very beneficial for some people at getting to a healthy weight. And I'm completely supportive of that. I think that's important. I think it's an open question whether or not restricting yourself to eating only during an 8-hour window, if you're still overeating, has any benefits. And I think the other thing that often is not discussed, and it's kind of unfortunate, is what are the side effects of these diets, right? Mm. And by side effects, we can think about, you know, like physical side effects, but I tend to think also about psychological side effects. I've known a lot of people who have dabbled with caloric restriction, intermittent fasting, time-restricted feeding, and it's been my impression that some of them have had negative psychological consequences to doing that. And that gets completely left out of the discussion. So I think there's a lot of complexity here that we don't often discuss when we're talking about dietary interventions And I think it's important to think about those things.
So what exactly is the molecular mechanism of fasting? Why is it, if that's if we can easily point that out, does it have to do with glucose? Is it mTOR signaling? What is it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the real answer is that's still being determined. So we know some of the, pieces. So I would, again, think of it as a puzzle, right? We have maybe half of the puzzle put together here for how caloric restriction and fasting, but fasting with caloric restriction, can have benefits in laboratory animals. Certainly inhibition of mTOR is part of the story. So again, rapamycin is a drug that inhibits mTOR, but mTOR, the protein, is a nutrient sensing protein. It's kind of, you can think of it kind of as the central gatekeeper that senses the environment, particularly nutrient levels in the environment, and then helps the cell make a decision whether it's time to grow and reproduce or shut down growth and become stress resistant. So mTOR senses nutrients. When there's lots of nutrients around, that's a pro-growth signal, and mTOR gets activated, and that promotes growth and reproduction. When nutrients are low, like under caloric restriction or in extreme case, fasting, mTOR gets inhibited. That turns down growth and enhances stress resistance. So mTOR is one piece that seems to be important for the response to caloric restriction. And again, I think I want to be precise and say it's one piece of the beneficial response to caloric restriction, but it's probably also one piece of the, if there are detrimental responses to caloric restriction in some genetic backgrounds, for example, that could also be due to mTOR inhibition. But that's one thing that is important. And then downstream of mTOR, which you hear talked about a lot, is activation of this process called autophagy. So when mTOR is inhibited, autophagy gets turned up. So you can think of it as fasting turns down mTOR, turns up autophagy, sort of arrows, causal arrows there. And autophagy people really like because intuitively it makes sense. So autophagy is this process of breaking down damaged macromolecules that have accumulated over time. So it feels good, right? It's like the garbage collector recycling centers coming in, breaking down the damage, and then you build new stuff, right, which is not damaged. So it's a nice model, and I think there's a lot of truth to it, but it's not everything that's happening. So there are some other things that caloric restriction or fasting does that are independent of mTOR. There are a bunch of effects on metabolism, glucose metabolism, and mitochondrial function that are independent of mTOR that probably play a role in some of the benefits and maybe detriments that come from caloric restriction and fasting. There are hormonal changes that go along with fasting and caloric restriction. So there are some circulating hormones that get turned up or turned down. Sex hormones also get turned up and turned down. So it's an immensely complicated biological response that we have when we go into this nutrient deprived state. And I think, again, people are still really figuring out what all of the important players are. The last thing that I'll add to this is I also sort of think of caloric restriction like what I would call a very dirty drug. And what I mean by that is that there are tens of thousands of biochemical reactions that are affected by caloric restriction. Whereas if you compare that to something like rapamycin, which is biochemically a very clean drug, it only does one thing, as far as we know, it inhibits mTOR. So I would say, you know, rapamycin has specific effects. Caloric restriction inhibits mTOR, and it does a bunch of other stuff. And we don't know what all of the pluses and minuses are of all of that other stuff yet. We're still figuring that out.
Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask if these studies were also done in women, because I know that this population is very underserved when it comes to academic research. And this is just due to the amount of changes, you know, hormonally that a woman goes through. And when we speak about calorie restriction, I always have to think as it relates to fertility and hormonal health for women. So everything that you're describing, calorie restriction being the most important, is this across the board for men and women, or is it mainly just targeted at 40 years and over, or is this across the lifespan?
Right. So again, I can tell you what we know in mice and rats, right? I think we don't know a lot in humans, right? So again, I would even go as far as to say it is unclear whether caloric restriction writ large is beneficial for longevity and health span in people beyond the going from an unhealthy weight to a healthy weight. In fact, I would have serious reservations if somebody is at a healthy weight, telling them they should practice caloric restriction for longevity. I actually don't think that's a good idea given what we know now. So we know a lot in laboratory animals, but laboratory animals are very different, and obviously genetically they're inbred usually, and they live in a very sterile environment. And so I just want to be careful about that extrapolation. So one of the things I will say about the laboratory studies is I think that the aging field, the geroscience field, has actually been better than most when it comes to looking at both male and female animals in our studies. So caloric restriction absolutely can extend lifespan in both male mice and female mice. And rapamycin also extends lifespan in male mice and female mice. Some of the other interventions that have been shown to extend lifespan only work in males or only work in females. But I think the field has been pretty good at looking at that. We don't know we don't understand the mechanisms yet, but at least the field is paying attention. In humans, you know, I don't think there have been really good long-term studies of caloric restriction. The best is probably what's called the calorie study, that was funded by NIH, where they had a series of controlled caloric restriction experiments ranging from 6 months to, I think, 2 to 3 years. So that's about the longest term studies that have ever been done. Those studies were mostly done in people who are overweight or obese. So again, this gets back to the question of, you know, maybe caloric restriction would be really beneficial for people who are overweight and obese. It might actually be quite detrimental for people who are starting from a healthy weight.
Oh, that's really interesting. Okay, so you've spoken a lot about mTOR and rapamycin being the drug that inhibits mTOR. We hear mTOR as it relates to red meat, for example. There's so many diets out there, and you've got the carnivores, and then you've got the vegans and the plant-based dieters. What is going on here when it comes to specifically protein, we'll call it, and yeah. mTOR? And if indeed, okay, you know, down signaling of mTOR is great for lifespan, then does that mean we should all just be trying our best to inhibit mTOR? And why are we not all taking rapamycin, the drug?
Okay, so there's multiple questions there. They're all complicated. So I'll start with the protein question. So I think first of all, I think people have to get over the simple answer, mTOR good, mTOR bad. It's not like that, right? So I think the biochemistry tells us that amino acids are one of the potent signals that mTOR senses. Amino acids are what make up proteins, that mTOR senses to determine nutrient level. So amino acids, or you can think protein, if you want to take a simplification step, activates mTOR. So at that level, you might assume that high protein is the opposite of rapamycin, because rapamycin inhibits mTOR. And that's kind of right. But I think you have to appreciate that in an animal, right, a human, let's just say a human being, because we are animals, in a human being, mTOR is not high or low. It's going through cycles, right, of activation and inactivation. And you actually need both. You need mTOR activation to build muscle, for example, or to build anything, really. So it's not that we want to keep mTOR chronically off or chronically on. What you want to do is try to optimize the cycles of mTOR activation and inactivation. And I'll add another layer of complexity that makes this even harder. The optimal cycles are going to be different in different tissues. So the optimal level of mTOR activity in the brain or the liver is probably going to be different than the optimal activity in muscle. Okay, so I'm just pointing out these complexities because I can't give a simple answer to your question, because biology is complicated and humans are complicated animals. And as you can probably tell, I get frustrated with influencers who want to make simple answers seem true, because they're not. Okay, so the question that comes up that we don't know the answer to is, what level of protein is optimal for healthy longevity in humans? This is actually, I think, a pretty controversial question right now. And in part, it's controversial because people come out with very strong opinions that they state as fact when we don't know the answer is the truth. So what we know from mice is if you restrict protein, much like caloric restriction, sometimes you can extend lifespan and you can get pretty robust extensions of lifespan. That's probably at least in part through inhibition of mTOR. We also know in people that if you're protein deficient, there are some real problems that come along with that. You lose muscle mass and you become frail. That's particularly true in the elderly, where maintenance of muscle mass is one of the most important aspects of maintaining functional health. So the epidemiological data today, I think, suggests that at least for people over 50, protein restriction is a pretty bad idea. And I don't know about under 50. I think you could make a case that maybe a lower protein diet is optimal. But I think if you're over 50, I wouldn't go there because I think maintaining muscle mass is really important. I think the other thing that is often misappreciated about protein even is what do we mean by low protein or high protein? Most people start from the RDA, the recommended daily allowance. They start from the RDA not realizing that the RDA is actually the recommended minimum allowance. That's the minimum amount of protein that an average, I think this was done in men, getting back to your point about men and women, an average sedentary man needs to eat not to lose muscle mass. So, you know, I don't think we could.
I think that's around 1 gram or 1.1. I think the RDA 1.1 per kilo of lean body mass. Yeah.
That's right. Is it lean body mass or total body? I think it's total body mass.
Okay. I'm getting that confused with how to grow or increase hypertrophy, which right now the standards are around 1.6 per kilo of lean body mass. Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. And I mean, most people don't even know what their lean body mass is. So how useful that number, I'm talking about the general public, right? Mm. How useful that number really is, I don't know. But I think it is useful to appreciate that when we talk about low protein versus high protein, what we're using as the baseline is really important. I don't think the RDA is a good baseline because I would say that is a low protein diet. That is the minimum that you need to maintain muscle mass if you're sedentary, at least if you're a man between the ages of whatever ages they did that study in, right? So it's a limited sort of study to begin with. Okay. So I think that's partly why I don't really feel comfortable saying people should do X, Y, and Z when it comes to protein because we don't know for sure. What I would say is if you're over 50 and you're, especially if you're active, you probably want to err towards the high end of protein. I haven't seen a lot of data that convinces me that unless you're being crazy high protein, that there are really any significant risks that go along with eating a higher protein diet in people who are over the age of 50. There might be a slight uptick in cancer risk, but it's pretty tiny. Let me make this is a big but, that should be in the context of a diet where you're not gaining weight, right? So if you're eating a diet that is where you're eating too many total calories and you're putting high protein on top of that, I think that's a very different situation. Whereas if you're eating a diet that maintains you at a healthy weight, that's high in protein. And again, that's where a lot of these recommendations you get mixed up, right? Because people hear, oh, I should eat a high protein diet. I should eat a lot of protein bars. But they're also, you know, eating a lot of fat and eating a lot of sugar and becoming obese. I think the effects of high protein are probably very different in an obesogenic diet, which is what a lot of people unfortunately eat versus a healthy diet. So I would say personally, for me, I tend to try to eat a relatively high protein diet in the context of what I think is a relatively healthy diet, which really just means, you know, cutting out the simple sugars and cutting out the ultra processed foods. I mean, if you have to start somewhere, I think that's a pretty good place to start. So I don't know if I answered your question.
But, no, you did. And I love what you said, because I always speak about just start with Mother Nature's gifts. You know, there's so many people out there buying supplements. And I always say, if you can't so much as squat your own body weight, or if you're not sleeping at least 8 hours per night and you're not exercising, what do you think a supplement is going to do? So what you just said really defines part of my thesis, which is start with what Mother Nature gave you and then work your way up from there. Something really interesting I wanted to ask you mentioned cancer. So when it comes to a, let's just say somebody, when it comes to a cancer cell, okay, and a normal uncancerous cell, if you turn off mTOR in a cancer cell, what would happen?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So, and that's actually what a lot of the excitement about rapamycin was aimed towards when it was first being developed, as the idea being that it could be a really potent anti-cancer drug. Sorry. Really potent anti-cancer drug. So what turns out is that many cancers, actually the way they become cancerous is by evolving to ignore mTOR. So it turns out that rapamycin isn't as potent of an anti-cancer drug in existing cancers, because as part of that progression to becoming metastatic is to evade mTOR. So turning down mTOR in that context isn't effective anymore, because those cancers have had mutations that allow them to not respond appropriately. I think where rapamycin has the biggest anti-cancer effect is in precancers by two mechanisms. So precancers, rapamycin, those will still be sensitive to the mTOR inhibition signals that will turn down growth and slow the growth of those precancers, which will allow then our anti-cancer, our intrinsic anti-cancer mechanisms to detect those cancers and clear them. The other piece of how I think rapamycin is preventing age-related cancers, at least in mice, potentially in people, is by rejuvenating immune function. So we know that the immune system is our most potent anti-cancer mechanism when we're young, because it can detect and kill cancers early. As we get older, the ability of the immune system to detect and clear cancers degrades, which is probably the leading reason why we see an exponential increase in most cancers with age. We also know that rapamycin, short-term rapamycin treatment in mice, and there's evidence in people now, can restore the ability of the immune system to function properly in an aged context. And my intuition, this is now speculation, I don't think anybody has shown this, my intuition is that's why mice that get rapamycin have fewer age-related cancers, is because we have restored the ability of the immune system to detect and clear those cancers. And I think there's potential that that could also be true in people.
So then that brings me to a really, I've already asked you this question. It might sound really uneducated, but why can't we just take rapamycin?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. I actually pose that question often when I'm giving talks, right? I go through the long list of all the stuff we know about rapamycin, how beneficial it is in animal models and some evidence in people. Why aren't we all taking rapamycin? I think it's, there's a few things that come into play there. One is the way that rapamycin was developed clinically, I think, plays a role. And so rapamycin was developed clinically as an immunosuppressant, as a drug that can be used in organ transplant patients to prevent transplant rejection. That's how it was first approved by the FDA. And in that context, rapamycin is given to people who have had an organ transplant. They're already taking strong immunosuppressants, and rapamycin is given on top of that at high daily doses. And in that context, there are some side effects associated with rapamycin. They're not as bad as most physicians who kind of know, have heard of rapamycin, or I guess I should clarify, in the clinical world, rapamycin is called sirolimus or sirolimus. It's the same drug, two different words. So I'm going to say rapamycin, but if you're familiar with sirolimus, it's the same drug. So most physicians who have heard of rapamycin or sirolimus think it has bad side effects because of the context in which it was developed and used clinically. And that bad reputation makes it very hard, both for individuals or organizations that want to do clinical trials of rapamycin in different contexts, to do those trials. It also makes it challenging for a physician who might want to prescribe rapamycin off-label to their patients to feel comfortable doing that for two reasons. One, they might be worried about the side effect profile themselves for their patients. Two, they're going to be worried about the legal ramifications if they prescribe rapamycin to their patients off-label. So I think that's been a huge barrier both to off-label use of rapamycin in the clinical community and to probably more importantly, clinical trials to actually test what are the side effects of rapamycin in different patient populations and what are the benefits. The other major reason why rapamycin hasn't been further developed is because it's off patent. So there's no financial incentive for biotech companies, pharmaceutical companies to repurpose rapamycin. Maybe I shouldn't say no. There's little financial incentive for those companies to repurpose rapamycin for other indications, despite the fact that there is a whole bunch of indications that the literature says there's a pretty good chance rapamycin could benefit patients, which is pretty frustrating, I think, for people who know that literature and are aware.
Oh, I'm sure a lot of cancer therapies and anti-aging therapies are very frustrating for people such as yourself and physicians out there who are really trying to help their patients. Another question I have, which is rampant on social media but often misunderstood, is NAD. We've got NAD, NAD precursors. We've got NAD drips now, which are, by the way, extremely expensive and very hard to come by. So I think and taking NAD or an NAD precursor via supplementation, I believe, doesn't even get into or penetrate the cell, if I'm not correct.
Depends on who you ask.
Depends on who you ask. So that's why I'm asking you. Let's my question specifically is, what is NAD and how does it affect lifespan?
Okay. So NAD is a molecule that's abundant in all of our cells. It's what's called a cofactor for many, many different metabolic reactions, meaning that it needs to be present in order for those metabolic reactions to occur. There's thousands of chemical reactions in our cell that use NAD as a cofactor. It's also used as what's called a substrate, which is a different kind of biochemical purpose for some chemical reactions where it's broken down. And the most famous enzymes that use NAD as a substrate are sirtuins, which we can talk more about sirtuins if you want to in a minute. I'm just going through this because I think it's hard to say, what does NAD do that's important in our cells? Because it does so much, right? So it's essential for life, and it's essential for hundreds or thousands of different processes within our cells. So it's fundamentally important biology for all living organisms. Why is it interesting in the context of aging? So there has been accumulating evidence that I think is okay, that with age, in at least some animals and potentially in people, there is a decline in the level of NAD that's available to carry out these chemical reactions. And that's true of lots of things. So one way to think about this is changes in NAD availability are one of the many, many, many things that change with age. And the question is, if we could prevent that decline or maybe restore the NAD, would that be beneficial? Would that offset some of the functional declines, diseases of aging? And so lots of people have been studying that. And again, I'm going to go to the laboratory studies first. I think the literature there is mixed. So there have been studies that report that you can supplement not with NAD directly, but with NAD precursors like nicotinamide riboside, nicotinamide mononucleotide in mice. You can see improvements in health span in some cases. One study reported an increase in lifespan. So there's data to support that.
One study.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is what it is, right? But that's where I'm going to go next. But then you've got this whole maybe equally sized body of data that hasn't been able to reproduce some of those results where there wasn't an increase in lifespan. And so this is a question that comes up a lot in science. If you have contradictory results, what do you believe? Do you believe the positive result or do you believe the negative result? Or my view is you wait and see until you get more data. So I think we don't really know. So where I would say we're at is I'm absolutely confident that NAD is important in aging because it's important for life. What I think we don't know is if you can restore or boost NAD levels in the context of aging, how effective that's going to be at increasing lifespan and health span. That's question number one. Question number two, which is what I think you were alluding to about availability of these precursors, is are the current crop of NAD, what are called NAD boosters, nicotinamide riboside, nicotinamide mononucleotide, are those effective at maintaining or boosting NAD levels? So there's two questions. One, do those precursors actually do what they're claimed to do? Two, if they do, how big are the benefits going to be? And I think those are both still open questions. I'm not an expert in the arguments back and forth about the availability of nicotinamide riboside versus nicotinamide mononucleotide. I know the people involved. I'm not going to comment on any individuals. I'll just say that it seems to me like those are not hard questions to resolve for serious scientists. I don't understand why those questions haven't been resolved yet. The one thing that seems likely to me is it does seem like there's an accumulating body of evidence that much of the nicotinamide riboside or nicotinamide mononucleotide that is taken orally gets broken down by the gut microbiome. So it probably doesn't matter. If you're like one or the other argument, if you're taking it orally, it probably doesn't matter. So that's kind of where my take is on the NAD boosters. I'm just kind of waiting to see how it all plays out. There's a lot of smoke. There's not a lot of fire at this point is how I think about it. The other thing I would say, though, I want to come back to a point you made earlier, which is even if the NAD boosters are valuable, if you don't get the rest of your house in order by exercising and eating properly, they're not going to help. Mm. At least I'm very doubtful they're going to help. So I would put that in the class of, you know, maybe once you've got the rest of your lifestyle taken care of, think about those things. But I wouldn't put any stock in the idea that they're going to help you if you're not doing the other foundational stuff.
Yeah, I'm always really interested in debunking the myths that are just costing people so much money. I can't tell you how many times I go on social media and people are just now doing these IV vitamin B IVs, or you know, I don't know if people are doing NADs. I know it does cost maybe $1,000 for a bag, and it's just, you know, thinking that just that one time fix is going to help everything. It's actually not. You have to, if it is valid and there's validity around doing this, you have to be doing this ongoing. It's not just a one-off thing. So right. I think it's a murky territory. But let's actually get into some of Mother Nature's gifts. Even though you said epigenetics can't really have that much of a profound effect on lifespan. That's what you said earlier in the episode. Is that correct?
I said it hasn't been shown to.
Hasn't been shown to. Okay.
Yeah. So I think the experiment hasn't been done. That's the limitation to a lot of what gets presented to the general public. Nobody's actually shown that this can have this effect yet. It might. And I think I'm cautiously optimistic, put it that way.
Yeah, I am too, with my limited information. But something that I've been diving deep into is the effects of exercise on mitochondrial efficiency. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, one of the hallmarks to aging is mitochondrial dysfunction. Is that correct? Yes.
Yep, that's right.
So when we look at, and I always come from a, you know, neurospace, so I'm always looking at what lifestyle interventions can we put into place to delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease, for example. And we know through clinical studies is now that exercise, specifically strength training, can help delay the onset, but also delay the progression of Alzheimer's disease. Now, one thing that I'm really looking into is zone 2 training as it affects the mitochondria. And I'm going to be interviewing Inigo Sainmalan, if I've said his name correctly, and he's done amazing in this space to, you know, clarify what zone 2 is. So let's talk about mitochondria and mitochondrial dysfunction and how exercise ties into the longevity aspect.
Sure. So let's start with mitochondria. I mean, I would say mitochondria and exercise, again, are kind of like mTOR and caloric restriction. They're overlapping, but not identical, right? So not all of the effects of exercise are going to be mediated through the improvements in mitochondrial function, but definitely that's part of it. So what we know about mitochondria and aging, so again, just to start from the sort of simplistic highest level, you know, mitochondria, most people think of them like as the powerhouses of the cell. That's where ATP gets produced, and ATP is the energy currency of the cell that we need to carry out all of our chemical reactions. But mitochondria do a bunch of other stuff in addition to generating ATP that isn't really as appreciated. They're necessary for production of things called iron sulfur cluster proteins. And a bunch of other processes that the cell needs to survive in addition to producing energy. And I think that's underappreciated and probably pretty important. So we know that with age, there is a decline in mitochondrial integrity. There is an increase in mitochondrial mutations. So that's the other thing that's maybe important to appreciate about mitochondria. So we have DNA in our nucleus. That's the genome that we all think of. But the mitochondria themselves have their own genome. And that genome is actually much more sensitive to damage. And so it's much more likely to get a mutation that can affect function. So we know that mitochondria accumulate mutations as we get older. That leads to changes in mitochondrial structure, which can have an impact on their ability not only to produce ATP, but to do all of the other stuff that they need to do. There's an interesting connection to mTOR in that there is a specific type of autophagy that degrades mitochondria. It's called mitophagy. And that's thought to be important for helping to clean up that mitochondrial damage that occurs with aging. Mitophagy can become impaired with aging, which so it's sort of like this vicious, sort of like this vicious cycle where mitochondrial damage is accumulating, mitophagy gets impaired, so you get even more mitochondrial damage. So it's kind of fitting this exponential increase in damage. So why is that bad for the cell or the organism? One is probably a decrease in energy available to do all the jobs that the cell needs to do to continue to function. Another problem, though, is that there's accumulating evidence that as mitochondria become damaged, they sometimes become, you can think of it as leaky. And so things that should be inside the mitochondria, like mitochondrial DNA, get out into the rest of the cell. That actually turns on an inflammatory response, a sort of autoimmune response with age that causes our own bodies to attack our cells. And so there's this sort of hidden consequence of mitochondrial damage that contributes to chronic inflammation, which drives also a lot of the declines in functions and diseases of old age. So there's multiple ways that mitochondria can contribute to aging. And if we go back to the hallmarks of aging, I went through this exercise one time in a lecture. Actually, if people are interested, there's a video lecture in what's called the Age, AGE Presents lecture series that I gave, where I kind of go through the connections between the hallmarks of aging. There's five or six that you can draw an arrow from mitochondrial damage that it's affecting these other hallmarks. So again, damage to mitochondria can be a preceding factor for other types of damage that accumulate with aging. So I'll link that, by the way. Okay, great. The thing that I think is also important to appreciate, though, is that mitochondrial damage doesn't seem to be sufficient to create all of the aging symptoms or phenotypes that we see. So for example, there are a variety of human diseases that are mitochondrial diseases. Some of them are childhood diseases, like Leigh syndrome is a childhood mitochondrial disorder. Those kids don't look like they're aging in an accelerated way. So I would want to be careful and say that it doesn't seem like mitochondrial damage is everything. It's not enough to cause what we think of as aging, but it's a big part of the story. Okay. So then how does exercise fit into that? So we know that exercise is a very potent way for turning over damaged mitochondria and reinforcing the function of mitochondria. It's also a potent way to make new mitochondria. So especially resistance exercise, but cardiovascular exercise as well, can induce what's called mitochondrial biogenesis so that you make more mitochondria. Usually that's a good thing. As long as they get made properly, that's a good thing from an energetics perspective. So we know that's true. We know that's particularly true in muscle. And again, that makes perfect sense, right? Muscle is the tissue that is going to be most responsive to exercise. And I think that has a big impact on systemic health benefits of exercise, but it's certainly not everything. And I think it's important to appreciate that another important thing that exercise will do, at least if accompanied with an appropriate diet, is cause a reduction in adipose. Particularly visceral adipose is seems to be a big player in aging, negative effects of adipose on aging. And that reduction in adipose is important because with age, we know there's an accumulation of inflammatory signals that are coming from the adipose and affecting all of the other tissues in the body. And so I think that's an important aspect of exercise that I think many people are aware of, but it often doesn't get talked about in the context of the benefits of exercise for aging-related diseases or functional declines. And I think that's probably equally important as the effects that are happening in muscle itself.
You know, this space, I guess, is somewhat, it to me, it's a mystery because I hear everything that you're saying. But on the other hand, I look at my grandmother, who lived till 95, never exercised from my, you know, from what I know. She migrated to Australia from a little country. So she would have had a lot of stress. She had 9 children to look after, no money. And, you know, she did, however, eat from her garden and she made a lot of her bread. And right. to this day, I look at her and think, wow, she is my, you know, she is my queen. I think I just want to be like that. But, you know, didn't have any supplementation and didn't do any of these things that we're really speaking about. So how do you explain that?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple things to say. I mean, I think one is different people are different, right? So we can find anecdotal stories of, I'm not saying your grandma did this, but we can find anecdotal stories of people who really abused their bodies and still lived a long time, right? I think Jean Calment is sort of the famous example of this, the woman who is reported to be the longest lived person ever, lived to 122 plus years and smoked until she was like 107 or something like that, right? So ate chocolate every day. So I think we can find people, and we don't really understand why those people were not susceptible to the things that might kill most people. Other than they probably had what some people call a resilient genotype, right? So they had the luck of the genetic draw that they had a genotype that allowed them to be resistant to these insults that might come from a poor lifestyle. So I think that's one thing that's worth appreciating. Another thing that's worth appreciating is that I think a relatively healthy diet can make up for a lot of other sins. One sin maybe being sedentary. And I think being active and exercising can make up for a lot of other sins. One sin being maybe not having as healthy of a diet. So these things are interconnected, and it's not an all or nothing equation. So I think that's also important to appreciate. I mean, it sounds like your grandma probably ate a relatively healthy diet, or at least it wasn't a diet that the average American is eating today, right? So I think that 100%. The relative importance of exercise depends on the context of these other lifestyle factors that come into play. There's also a little bit of a luck of the draw that goes along with this, right? I mean, there are both genetic and environmental factors that are, you can think of it as a probabilistic thing, right? Your genotype, your genome, combined with your environment, and I would put most of the lifestyle interventions we talk about under environment, gives you a probability of certain health outcomes as you get older. But there is a stochastic randomness that comes into play as to which you're going to develop and when you're going to develop them. And so that's why I tend not to put a lot of faith in the sort of N of one anecdotal stories where we can say, yeah, but this person lived to be 105 years old and they drank, you know, a liter of gin every day. Doesn't mean that everybody should do that, right? I think we have to kind of be guided by population level data when we can and say, on average, and I think this is actually really important for people to appreciate, any recommendation that they're given, you know, I try not to give recommendations unless I'm pretty confident. But any recommendation you're given, there's going to be some uncertainty around that, right? We can say with, you know, X percent probability, if you do this, you're going to have a better chance of living a long and healthy life, but it's never 100% certainty because of that randomness that comes into play, combined with the fact that we probably understand a tiny percent of the biological complexity of how all of these things are fitting together. So that's why I think we kind of have to be guided by, you know, these large scale population level studies to tell us what works for most people or what doesn't work for most people, as is often the case. And we just have to accept we're not too truly personalized medicine yet, truly personalized interventions. We're making, you know, baby steps in that direction. We have some personalization that we can do now, but we're still far away from really being able to tell you specifically, you should do X, Y, and Z to optimize your probability of achieving, you know, this really good health outcome.
And this is why I think I've got this absolute horror, disgust on when I go onto social media and I see people giving guidelines and giving advice when you have millions of data points available that you just don't know. So how can we be giving this advice if, you know, I always say, I'm like, I don't understand how you can give this advice. If, have you even done a genetic test on this person? No. Oh, I mean, like that's starting point. Do you have their blood work? No. Well, then I can't understand how you're giving this advice. But something you said interesting was, you know, we've got environment plus genome equals expected outcomes. Okay. So right now, currently 50 million people worldwide are living with Alzheimer's disease, and that number is said to triple by the year 2050. Now, what we used to think of this disease as an E4, a genetic disease. If you have possessed the genes for Alzheimer's disease and you're going to, you know, mainly you might get that disease. But now we know that there are epigenetic factors that come into play. We know that environment, you know, plays a huge role. Sleep, especially, you know, detoxification of your brain during sleep can lead to these states. What is your take on neurodegenerative diseases and in your field of study?
Sure. So I want to say two things. One is I think the APOE4 example that you gave is a really good one, because I don't think anybody who actually understands biology ever thought that that was the whole story, right? So everything is a combination of genetics and environment. The relative importance of genetics and the relative importance of environment depends on the specific phenotype that you're talking about. So in the case of E4, I think increases risk of developing Alzheimer's disease by about fivefold if you have the two alleles. But clearly, there's this huge other component that is other genes and also environment that can modulate that. So I didn't mean that to be insulting when I said I don't think anybody who understands biology ever thought that. But the problem is this often gets oversimplified for the general public, right? And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, one message I would love people to understand is it's never, never that simple. It's always going to be genes and environment interacting together that are going to influence your risk of having a certain trait. And Alzheimer's disease is a trait. It is a phenotype that develops with age. So that's just, I think, important sort of foundational biology to understand. The other thing I'll make to talk to you about your question of neurodegeneration in the context of my field, which is the biology of aging. So having two alleles of APOE4 increases your risk about fivefold of developing Alzheimer's disease at some point in your life. Going from age 45 to 85 increases your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease by about two orders of magnitude more. So 100-fold more than the genetic risk, the greatest genetic risk factor. So dementias are diseases of the biology of aging. I think we can debate whether the biology of aging causes Alzheimer's disease. I would be happy to have that conversation. I think there's evidence both directions. There is no question that the biology of aging is the single greatest risk factor for whether or not you are going to get Alzheimer's disease. It creates a permissive physiological state that increases your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease by 1,000-fold-ish, at least 300-fold. Okay, so it's really important for these dementias of old age. And regardless of whether or not the biology of aging is directly causal from a biochemical or molecular perspective, given that it is the greatest risk factor, if we can modulate that biology, I think there are real opportunities to bring down that risk that goes along with biological aging or with chronological age. So let's just say that going from 45 to 85, I should know this, I don't remember off the top of my head, I think it's about 300-fold increase in risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Let's just say we can bring that down by 10-fold, right? That's a heavy lift. I'm not saying that's going to be easy, but I think it's possible by targeting the biology of aging, we can decrease your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease by tenfold going from age 45 to 85. That's a huge impact, right? That's a huge impact. So I think there's clearly a reason to be paying more attention than we have to the potential benefits that we could get from targeting the biology of aging for this progression of increased risk for developing Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. And we know a lot now about how this biology ties together, right? So for example, in every major animal model of Alzheimer's disease that exists, as far as I know, where people have looked, inhibiting mTOR is beneficial. It can delay the progression to disease in that model. And in some cases, it can actually reverse it, right? So that biology connects up. Every major animal model of Alzheimer's disease where this has been studied. Why the hell hasn't there been a clinical trial yet? Pisses me off. I mean, sorry.
I was actually going to ask you
It's one of my frustrations. Yeah.
No, I'm going to have to link and really look into this. And if you know any articles off the top of your head, maybe offline, you can send them to me. But that's interesting.
So Veronica Galvin and I wrote a review on this in 2009, basically saying, why hasn't anybody done a clinical trial yet?
And? Why hasn't
we got lots of people who said, yeah, way to go. We agree.
Yeah.
Hasn't moved the needle. I mean, so let me be fair. There have been a couple of small clinical trials that have started out of San Antonio, but they're all like tiny safety trials. So the needle has not moved since then. And actually, I've been proposing this since like 2012. The needle has not moved in the last decade. Yet we've known for more than a decade that there's a reasonably good chance that rapamycin could be beneficial in the context of dementia.
So that's a really bold claim. So are you looking at, let's just take a perfect view. Let's just say you got the funding, you were going to start looking at this. Would you take somebody with E4, would you take somebody, okay? And how far along, are you looking at serum levels of amyloid?
Okay. Right. What are the endpoints, I think, is what you're asking. I actually wouldn't. I mean, I think you would want to look at that. I wouldn't want that to be the endpoint because I think there's a lot of uncertainty in the field right now. To what extent is amyloid a good surrogate marker for disease progression, right? I think that's completely unclear to me. And my impression is it's pretty unclear to the people who are in the weeds in that area. So I'd want to look at that, but I wouldn't use that as a readout of whether rapamycin or whatever you're studying is working or not. So I think it's an important question. I think the real answer is it would depend a lot on what the resources were that were available, exactly how you would design the trial. My preference would be to have enough resources where you don't have to do the trial in people who already have a clinical diagnosis of dementia. I worry that that might be too late, even though there's some evidence from the mouse studies suggesting that in certain types of dementia, rapamycin can have a beneficial effect. I worry that you'd be shooting yourself in the foot potentially by starting too late. So I would like to see a trial done in people who are at high risk. Like you said, APOE4 homozygotes would be good candidates. I know many APOE4 homozygotes who are taking rapamycin off label for this reason, because they think that the risk reward favors reward. So I think that's a good population to think about. And maybe people who have mild cognitive impairment. So you have a pretty good idea of what the trajectory is probably going to look like, but they haven't yet progressed to full-blown dementia. I think that's a pretty reasonable place to start. I would want to see the endpoints be cognitive function. That's what's important, right? I don't care if it reduces amyloid, if it doesn't improve cognitive function. I don't think any family members would either, right? So that's what I would want to see.
Yeah, no, you're completely correct. It's interesting because back in 2019, my father had a right parietal lobe infarct, and since then he's just gone downhill in terms of his cognitive performance. He used to be sharp as a tack. Now he forgets things, and he's got a short fuse now. So I can see how this is affecting him. It's emotional changes, but not just for him, for the family as well. So I can only imagine what somebody goes through having to live with somebody with severe progressive Alzheimer's disease, which is really baffling why we're not, getting these clinical trials underway if there is some hope there for rapamycin.
And you want to know what the story is? I can tell you why it hasn't happened.
Oh, I already talked about
being off patent, right? So there's no financial incentive. And there is I'm going to be nice and say a lack of knowledge among many of the foundations in this space about the literature on rapamycin and the true risk profile. So the comment that I have gotten back when I've tried to advocate for this is that it's a risky drug. What are the real risks of rapamycin? The real risks are a slight uptick in risk of bacterial infection, which is easily treated with antibiotics, increased risk of high triglycerides, maybe an increased risk of glucose homeostasis. That's about it. So if you know, and there's no hope for Alzheimer's disease patients, if you know there's no hope, the direction this is going, if you were a family member or you were that person, would you accept the risk profile of rapamycin? I would say almost everybody who has a true understanding of what the real risk profile is would be willing to accept that. But the problem is there's a perception not based on data that has prevented people who were unwilling to actually look at the real data or learn it from taking the steps of to carrying out these clinical trials. It's also, I should also say, that's a little bit unfair because I should also say it's not just the funders. It's also the FDA. The FDA is hyper conservative when it comes to proposing new clinical trials for something like rapamycin. Again, they don't really take into account what the patient population is all the time when they're considering the risk reward profile. So that's my impression. It's a combination of there's a lack of financial incentive for companies to develop rapamycin for this purpose. And there is a misperception of the real risk profile based in large part on the organ transplant patients. But even there, I would say absolutely for myself, knowing what the risk profile is, if it was as bad as it is in organ transplant patients, and it wouldn't be, that still isn't that bad if you know you're going to get dementia, right? So I think that there just hasn't been a real realistic risk reward analysis done here. And I don't think that's unique to rapamycin. I think there are probably other therapies in the dementia world that would fall into that class that should have been tested by now, haven't been tested by now for some of the same reasons. And it's really unfortunate. It's frustrating. It's sad. If you spend too much time thinking about it, you know, it really is depressing.
What was that article that came out? I think it was maybe 2 months ago now. Because I'm just so into this conversation. He came out as a fraud for inventing this drug that he said had an effect on amyloid. Was that what it was?
Right. So I think the story is that there were a whole series of publications that had different degrees of falsification in them, supporting the amyloid hypothesis, right? The idea that amyloid was the primary cause of Alzheimer's disease. And so that led to, I think, an additional reevaluation of that that hypothesis. And yes, there was like a therapeutic intervention sort of involved as well. But I think I would say that I first started hearing about this real questioning of the amyloid hypothesis, you know, more than 10 years ago, with the idea that, is it really the plaques and tangles that are driving the disease, or are those maybe even protective responses for what's actually driving the disease? So there has been, I think, this increasing questioning of what had been considered dogma for decades in the field, you know, over the last 15 or 20 years. I think it's sort of reached a crescendo now with some of the questions about falsification of old data and the FDA approval of Aduhelm based on a surrogate endpoint of amyloid burden without any real evidence that it benefits patients in terms of cognitive function. Still TBD. I'm not saying that it doesn't, but I think that also created a lot of additional thinking in this area about, should we really be focusing all of our attention on amyloid as we're developing therapies and testing them?
Yeah, I mean, look, if you know, it has been, I've been reading about how it is a protective mechanism, but you've also got to look and reverse engineer it and ask yourself why they're becoming, you know, forming plaques and tangles, you know, where is it coming from? I think they've looked, you know, Dale Bredesen has, you know, published some conservative papers and other papers I question, around what leads to the aggregation of these proteins. So that's interesting.
I've read his book. I actually, Dale's book. I've read his book. I actually think it's, I mean, so it, maybe I shouldn't comment. I think there's a lot of good stuff in there. There's a lot of questionable stuff in there too. I honestly kind of tuned out when he started talking about resveratrol. And I was like, well, if he's talking about resveratrol, there's probably a lot of other garbage in there too. So sorry, Dale, if you're listening, but that's that was my honest response when I was reading your book.
It's so funny you said that, because he did bring out, you know, when I did that, when I read his book and his paper, when he spoke about resveratrol, I went and actually looked at the papers that he quoted. And in these papers, it actually said nothing about resveratrol as it relates to Alzheimer's disease. So I didn't understand how he, why he even included these references, because I really looked into them. So that was only my only take on that. But resveratrol. Wine. You know, David Sinclair talks about this. We haven't even gotten into sirtuins, but what's your take on resveratrol? Because I'm seeing a lot of people now, you know, going and spending, I don't know how much money on these resveratrol vitamins, if you will, or supplements. So are they worth it?
I don't know if they're worth it, because I don't know if they do anything. So what I can tell you is the backstory on this is pretty simple. So David published a paper showing that resveratrol could increase lifespan. This was in yeast. That's how the whole thing got started. That paper is wrong, has not been reproduced. We couldn't reproduce it. Other people couldn't reproduce it. Should have been retracted, hasn't been retracted. That, though, led to the next paper, which claimed that resveratrol could increase survival in mice fed a high-fat diet. I think there's some truth to that. I don't have any reason to disbelieve that data. I think it probably depends on the diet that's used, but that was used to sort of create this machine, right? That the red wine drug was a miracle drug and slowed aging. I don't think there's any good evidence that resveratrol significantly targets the biology of aging or has an impact on lifespan or health span in anything other than C. elegans. So I think in the nematode worm, there's evidence both directions. I think it depending a little bit on the conditions, it might. In yeast, it doesn't. And in mice, it doesn't extend lifespan. It's taken 15 years so far to clean up the literature, and it's not clean yet, I would say. Millions of dollars have been wasted, in my view. Is resveratrol a sirtuin activator? I think that's a different question. That gets into the weeds really quickly. I think that still remains to be determined. It probably can activate sirtuins towards a very narrow set of substrates. It probably doesn't activate sirtuins in a true biological setting in cells or animals. So in a test tube, yes, you can get it to activate sirtuins. Unclear if it can activate sirtuins in a real biological setting. It might. We don't know. Certainly not at the doses most people are taking it. Could it have other effects? Sure, it could. I can't say it doesn't have beneficial health effects in some contexts.
I'm not sure. Yeah. And something else I'm not sure of is, you know, advocating for the one or two glasses of wine per day.
That's a different question. Right. So, I mean, I think yes, it makes absolutely zero sense to say that you should drink one or two glasses of wine to get resveratrol. The amount of resveratrol in one or two glasses of wine is so small that it that's nonsense. You would have to drink, I think it's 1,000 bottles of wine a day to get the same dose that they gave the mice. So yeah, that is complete BS. There is epidemiological literature that moderate consumption of alcohol, and that means different things in different populations, one drink per day for women, two drinks per day for men in the United States, that has a slight benefit for all-cause mortality, probably more significant benefit for heart disease through mechanisms that still remain to be determined. It might be slightly better in red wine. It might not be, but for moderate alcohol consumption, that's what the epidemiological data says. So I think that's just a fact. Does that mean we should tell people they should moderately consume alcohol? Probably not. I mean, there is a significant fraction of people that have trouble moderately consuming alcohol, right? And so it's a slippery slope that I think we probably shouldn't go down in recommending to people that they moderately consume alcohol. On the other hand, I'm not a teetotaler. I think if you want to go out and have wine at dinner with your friends or have a couple of beers at the bar, go do that, right? I'm not saying don't ever drink, but from a public health perspective, it probably doesn't make sense to tell people they should moderately consume alcohol, is my take.
The dose makes the poison, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, let's wrap up and talk about what your biggest takeaways are as it relates to longevity and lifespan. So we've already spoken about a calorie restriction. That's one of them. You haven't spoken about sleep yet. So I'm hoping that is in your matrix.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I would say, first of all, I would say my sort of foundation for healthy longevity is pretty obvious, right? I mean, it's the stuff that works, I would say. So personally, what I do, I prioritize resistance training. I lift weights 3 times a week. I think almost everybody should do that. I think that's really, really important. And then I try to do cardiovascular training, 3 times a week as well. I don't worry so much. Like I really respect Peter Attia. I know some people disagree with him, but in general, I think he's highly credible, does his homework. But he also gets way more into the weeds than I do with exactly what type of exercise and how much and all of that stuff. I think that can benefit some people, but I think if you just start with the basics, that'll get you 90% of the way there. So I don't worry a lot about what zone training I'm in and that stuff yet. Maybe I'll get there when I get to the next level. So I do exercise is foundation number one or two. Mm-hmm. Diet is the other one. Again, I don't get over the top, conservative about what I eat, but I try to prioritize cutting back on simple sugars, cutting back on processed foods. I eat a relatively high protein diet. That's my diet. And I try to maintain my weight. Sleep, absolutely critically important. This is an area where I am not an expert. I am one of those fortunate people that I sleep well. And so I haven't had to really try a lot of strategies that I know other people have to try to get good sleep. I pretty solidly get 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night. I think that's absolutely critically important. That can, sabotage the rest of your lifestyle plan if you're not getting good sleep. But I haven't had to spend a lot of time trying stuff. So I guess what I would say is, I think it's probably like nutrition. You get it. There's a lot of noise out there. You get a lot of people telling you should do this, that, and the other thing. I think people should get a little bit comfortable with self-experimenting and trying one thing at a time and figuring out what works for you. I think that's true in diet as well. There's not one dietary strategy that fits everybody. So you kind of have to figure out what works for you, what's sustainable. But I'm not going to make recommendations on sleep because it's not something I've personally experienced. I haven't had to really worry so much about that. I think the one that honestly gets neglected a lot is happiness. And I don't think there's an easy fix there. But I think if you're unhappy, if you're miserable, what's the point of living a long and healthy life? Like, you got to figure out a way to be happy in your own life. And again, I'm not yet a happiness guru, so I can't tell you the path to get there. But if you're unhappy, I think spending some time thinking about what's causing your unhappiness is worth investing that time. A mentor of mine has really solidified this in my thinking. I think people neglect the happiness factor when they make important decisions in their life. And spending a little more time thinking about, will this decision make me happy, has a big impact. So again, I know that sounds like fluff and it's not in my biology of aging expertise, but from a human perspective, I think it's really important. And I think it gets underemphasized when a lot of people are spending so much time worrying about their diet and their exercise and this, that, and their supplement stack, and they're miserable. If you're miserable, you spend some time there and you can spend a little bit less time on the other stuff.
Oh, wow, Matt, you hit the nail on the head with that one. You're absolutely amazing. Where can we point people to go and, I guess, connect with you, follow you?
Yeah. So if you want to learn more about my research, my lab site is CaberlineLab.org. If you want to learn more about the Dog Aging Project, website is DogAgingProject.org. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I have a love-hate relationship with Twitter, like most people. So I go through periods of activity and inactivity at MCaberline on Twitter. I'm going to be trying to have a little bit more of a presence with videos and content like that. So keep your eyes open. Okay. I'll be a little bit more out there.
We are excited. Thank you so much for being part of the Neuro Experience.
Sure. Thank you. It's been fun.
Matt, I could have